So I'm doubly honored to be asked to give this lecture. Doubly first because the person who invited me is Dotan Uliar, who was not too many years ago my student at Harvard. Dotan was a challenging student. He was intensely serious, demanding, in the best sense, insistent upon pressing arguments hard and unwilling to let sloppy thinking go tolerated. So it was a pleasure to have him as a student, and it's very nice to see him so productively and happily engaged in teaching here. And that was an extraordinarily kind introduction you just provided. Second reason why it's a pleasure to be here is the person for whom this lecture is named is at least one step removed, close to me. So my colleague at Harvard, Jonathan Zittrain, to whom Dotan alluded, is one of the pioneers in cyber law. Has among his other great strengths serious grounding in computer science, and that plus remarkable imagination and range makes him a wonderful colleague, and so I'm honored to be here speaking in the lecture series that his father founded. So I will be talking today on the subject of distributed creativity, which is probably a slightly mysterious title. I'll try to make it clear as we go along. This is an article in progress, something I've been mulling over for a long time, but I'm just now in the process of putting down on paper. I'd be eager to hear your reactions. As you'll see, some of the examples, phenomena I'll be discussing today encroach upon zones of social activity that I actually don't know much about, and you know more than I do. Others I do know a fair amount about, but so I'll be very interested in your feedback. So what I mean to focus on are two related sets of activities, one of which is well known, the other which is much less known, at least among people who practice and write about law. First of all, can you see this? Maybe you need a little... visible? Okay. So the zone of activities that are well known and in which many of you probably engage consists of user modifications of intangible products. So this has become increasingly common in the last, roughly speaking, 15 years, and there's a lot of legal doctrine that addresses this, and so correspondingly a lot of legal scholarship. So user modifications of intangible products, meaning the ways that the recipients, what we used to call consumers of such products, changed them, include things like mashups, exemplified by the Gray Album, edits, exemplified by the many modifications of the Star Wars movies now in circulation on the web, parody, like the Bush Blair video, or the wonderful faux trailer called The Shining, fan fiction, of which Becca Tushnet, written so provocatively. Mary Sue fiction, a little less well known, which involves bringing a neglected character in the background of a story to the fore and retelling the character from that person's standpoint, or inserting a new character into an otherwise familiar story, often the personality of the narrator. Slash narratives, which involve taking characters in a fictional setting and putting them in unusual juxtaposition, often involving homosexual, male homosexual relations. Real person slash, a growing phenomenon on the web, which involves taking characters of real people, not fictional characters, and writing fictional stories about their homosexual relationships. Machinima, this is a mechanism for taking vignettes or plots acted out through computer games, capturing them through in a video format and creating out of them low-budget movies. Graphic arts, which frequently these days begin with and build upon copyrighted raw materials, like Shepard Fairey's poster of Obama, which just underlies the famous hope image. Computer games, modifications of commercially developed games like Sims, which enable the users to build their own versions unauthorized by the game developer. So these all involve, to repeat, user modifications of intangible products. They implicate copyright law. So many of them are the subjects of intense copyright litigation, and there is, as I suggested, correspondingly a large literature by scholars assessing the degree to which copyright owners ought to be able to control such behavior or ought not. So that's the well-known set of phenomena. What I mean to concentrate on here is a parallel but neglected set of activities. These all involve user modifications of tangible products. So here are some instances. As Eric von Hippel at MIT has shown, he's one of the pioneers in this small field, many sports equipment innovations grew out of not manufacturers, but users. An example is high-performance windsurfing. All the components of this, most importantly including the foot straps and the skeg, arise out of user innovation. The manufacturers then appropriate. Same with kite surfing. Almost all the innovation involving kite surfing arises out of kite surfers, not the manufacturers who provide now the finished products. Ice climbing. Much of the innovation here was driven by climbers. So for instance, the leash that's attached to this ice hammer that enables people to hang from their tools on vertical waterfalls were developed by initially by users and then subsequently appropriated by manufacturers. Fishing equipment. It's common for fly fishermen to purchase graphite rods like this and to sand them with fine grain sandpaper to remove the sheen, which makes it less likely for the fish to be frightened by the reflection. Basketball shoes. Large communities, thousands of people participate in websites. This is one, Nike Talk, exchanging designs for modified versions of basketball shoes. So this is a design by Vascal Digital 123 for a shoe he calls Odonata. Notice, in case you didn't get it, the nose of the shoe he's demonstrating is meant to look like the mouth of a shark. But it's not merely the exterior that this user is designing. He also designs the internal structure of the shoe, its soles, how it works ergonomically. Now notice in each of these images, there's a Nike swoosh. This is unauthorized. Bicycles have been modified for a long period of time, but increasingly commonly now in developing countries to support other kinds of activities unanticipated by their manufacturers. Here's an example, the use of a bicycle to provide the mechanism for a windmill, enabling this innovator, William, to translate wind power into a simple turbine that charges cell phones, which are widely available in rural Africa now, even where there is no electricity. Bicycle-powered knife sharpening machines. If at your leisure you go to this address, you'll see a YouTube video showing how an African knife sharpener has adapted a bicycle to both get him to and fro his customers, but also then to prop up the rear wheel on a little stand, enabling him then by pedaling to drive the sharpening stone. iPhones. Here we enter a zone that most of you are probably familiar with. This you undoubtedly know you can get a variety of Apple-authorized applications to load on your iPhone, which makes it a good deal more flexible than the version that comes out of the box. But the number of authorized applications is exceeded by a large set of applications that Apple does not permit you to employ. To engage in user modification at that level, you have to first jailbreak your phone using readily available software. And once you've done so, you have access to this world of applications like Quick Scroll, which enables more rapid and convenient scrolling through materials on your iPhone. Instinctive Shuffle, which is an upgraded version of the shuffle system that exists on iPhones generally. Its difference is that it pays attention to what during a given session you are fast-forwarding through, what you're skipping, and then modifies the set of the repertoire that it presents to you to match your current mood. An application might be useful this evening, enables you to track in real time baseball scores. This is another unauthorized application. Here's another one, less savory. This one enables you to sync your iPhone to more than one iTunes library. For obvious reasons, this raises copyright questions. Another example, cooks. So adaptation in cooking has been around for millennia. Somewhat more recently, there's a growing phenomenon of developing and then exchanging information about modified tools for cooking. So for example, cooks frequently take strainers, not frequently, sometimes now, take strainers and line them with pantyhose to provide finer filtration of sauces. Paint rollers used to spread oil on grills more evenly than is possible using standard brushes. Fishing boats. Recreational fishing boats are constantly modified by purchasers, by consumers. Less well known is commercial fishing boats are modified by their purchasers as well. So here's some example. These are stern pickers. These are gillnet boats you find in the state of Washington and Alaska. The relevant portion of the next couple of slides is the stuff on the lower right-hand corner, which is descriptions of how each of these boats has been modified to make it more effective for fishing. It turns out there is really no standard version of a stern picker. They've all been modified to make them work better. Here's one of the few examples that has resulted in litigation thus far. This is a Mercury stern drive for a recreational boat. A serviceman who had one of these and was servicing the engines owned by others discovered that there was corrosion around the shaft that could be reduced by redesigning the housing to create a space allowing the water to more easily clear out the crud that would accumulate around the shaft. This was a sufficiently useful modification of the original device that he eventually, too late as it turned out in the end, sought a patent on it and was opposed by the manufacturer, which wanted to employ the new improved technology itself without compensation. Cars have been modified for generations. An especially dramatic zone of innovation involves lowriders. These are cars modified, at least initially, by members of the Chicano community in Southern California. The key to lowriders is to replace the shock absorbers with other devices that allow you to control the position of the wheels, making the cars run very low to the ground when cruising, and but can be controlled independently, so you can make the cars dance. Motorcycles also have been modified for a very long time. This is a classic Harley-Davidson Fat Boy. Some of the modifications can be made with kits that are provided by either the manufacturers themselves or third parties. But many users go well beyond the kits and develop modifications involving combinations of custom-made accessories, paint, and so forth. Notice this is over $60,000 has been invested in the customization of this particular motorcycle. Woodworking. Routerforums.com is a site where you can find a lot of discussion among woodworkers. One of the things that's important here is this is an example of which we've already seen some before, in which both professional and amateur modifiers share their work. So here is an arena in which you can exchange ideas about developing your own accessories for a router. A router is basically a motor, a high-speed motor that drives bits that cut things. Well, to make a router effective, you have to use it in conjunction with jigs that guide its position. And most jigs, there are some commercially available jigs, but most of them are made by users. And this is a forum in which they exchange ideas about how best to do so. Circuit bending involves taking low-grade electronic equipment, often kids' keyboards, and opening them up and rewiring them to make unusual sounds, and then writing compositions for those sounds and recording them. Again, there's a flourishing website exchanging ideas about how, in this case, this is how most effectively to rewire and attach little switches that enable you to control and produce different sounds out of a Casio keyboard. All right, that's a review of this field, which I suggest is extremely popular these days. But has been thus far neglected by lawyers, in part because relatively few of these cases has as yet resulted in litigation. The reason I'm going to suggest in a minute, that's likely soon to change. Okay, so technology. What does technology have to do with this phenomenon? Well, in terms of the ease with which you can engage in this behavior, technology sometimes increases it, sometimes decreases it. So the digitization of entertainment products combined with readily available software and hardware, generally speaking, makes modifications of intangible products easier. It's one of the reasons why we see such flourishing of mashup or remix culture. On the other hand, encryption, to the extent it functions effectively, makes modifications harder. And the complexity of consumer products often makes modifications more difficult. So it's harder now to customize a car than it used to be. So as I say, with respect to the ease of modification, technology has ambivalent effects. Its big impact, and the reason why this set of activities is now breaking into public view, is because technology radically increases opportunities to share information. So whereas these communities of innovators used to be real space communities, climbers who would share modifications among the members of their own friendship networks, now they tend to be global, in which the modifications are shared among users, and then sometimes, discuss some instances in a minute, shared between manufacturers and users. So what are the owners of the intellectual property rights in the goods that are being modified? Think about these behaviors. How do they react? Well, there's quite a range of reactions. So at one extreme, there are some who encourage behavior of just this sort. Some of them philanthropic. So here's an example, the Portable Light Project is a philanthropy that has developed photovoltaic cells in flexible form, suitable for sewing into clothing, and making them available to innovators to attach them to projects suited to their particular needs and locales. And so among the things that have been made from these cells are vests worn by Boda Boda drivers in East Africa. So a Boda Boda is, depending on the country, either a bicycle or a motorbike that functions as a taxi. So you need a ride, and you're more likely to hop on the back of one of these Boda Bodas than you are in to get a ride in a car. The drivers have need for electricity, first to power their cell phones, because they need to know where to go, and then after dark to power the lights on their bicycles. But they don't want to use generators that stay on the bicycles because they get stolen. So what they do is they make and then wear these vests that power the electricity. Okay, that's an instance of the most generous of the postures, a manufacturer who encourages this kind of modification. One step away from that is acquiescence. So some intellectual property owners here, example is Laura Malone, who's the Associate General Counsel for the AP, argued in a panel a couple of weeks ago that when thinking about what to do with people who make use of AP products, AP photos and so forth, without permission, her recommendation is pick your battles. That's how she describes AP's posture. Don't challenge remixes unless or until it appears they have legs, meaning they're going to become more popular or commercially viable, and pose a significant problem for AP, and only then do you go after them. So a general posture of holding back, acquiescence, until the monetary threat seems more substantial. Another step, restrict. Don't block altogether, but restrict opportunities for user modification. This is Apple's current strategy. So Apple's system for screening proposals for developing applications is that it allows most user-developed applications to be distributed for its phones with the following exceptions. No applications may touch or enhance the iTunes or iPod functionality. That's why the modified shuffle program I described earlier is not permitted. No processes may run in the background. That has the effect of disqualifying not just instant messaging systems, but also cut and paste applications. And somewhat more reasonably, no applications that facilitate copyright infringement. So some user modification is authorized and others not. Next step, a growing set of manufacturers are engaged in efforts to monetize the behaviors just described. And there turns out to be a large marketing literature encouraging firms to do this more actively. So how do you monetize this behavior? Well, you acquire patent rights in the user modifications. That's what Mercury has tried to do. You make available to your consumers toolkits which encourage and enable them more easily to engage in these modifications. The Sims does this, for example. You hold competitions, awarding prizes for the most effective modifications of your products. You engage in so-called co-design. That's where you encourage users to propose modifications to your products, to submit them to you. You mount them on websites available to all of your users. Your customers then vote on which are the most attractive, then you incorporate into your product the ones that seem most appealing. So a wide variety of ways of monetizing, and last but not least, prevent this behavior altogether. This was Apple's original strategy, and it is always a potential for firms that see their patent rights or their trademark rights threatened by this conduct. So if a firm wants to engage in one of these three practices, restriction, monetization, and prevention, how might it do so? Well, the tools available to the IP owners under these circumstances include, first of all, technology. So iPhones are designed to be relatively hard, although as you can see, not that hard, to jailbreak. principal threat, principal technological threat, is the hazard that if you do jailbreak your phone and then get a software upgrade, you can so-called, said to be brick your phone, I mean, turn it into a doorstop because it no longer functions at all. In the bicycle industry, Shimano is notorious for designing its parts, like the shifters on its bicycles, to those to be very hard to repair once they wear out, encouraging you to purchase more Shimano parts. Okay, technology is one way to control or discourage user innovation. Now, law. So the copyright system has obvious power here. With respect to modifications of intangible products, most of them involve making reproductions, derivative works, and often distribution of the copyrighted material, and therefore give rise to potential suits for copyright infringement. The right of publicity can be invoked to prevent a real person slash, and has been in some instances. Patent rights can be employed to the extent user innovation is generalized so as to violate the prohibition in Section 271 on making, using, or selling the patented product. A minor but not trivial doctrine in this patent field is the distinction between repairing and reconstructing a patented product. Some forms of user innovation involve the former, which is permissible. Some involve the latter, which is not permissible. Trademark law can be employed to bring suits against modified forms of the products that would either confuse consumers, is that really a Chevrolet, or dilute the brand by associating it with shoddy products. Contracts, end user license agreements, can be employed to forbid consumers to engage in behaviors of these sorts. And most manufacturers provide their warranties are violated by alteration of the underlying products. And finally, a combination of technology and law underlies the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's prohibition into Section 1201, among other things, of circumventing technology that effectively controls access to a copyrighted work. One of the exceptions to this prohibition permits modifications of cell phones, but only for the purpose of connecting to a lawful network, not for the purpose of engaging in all the other fun things you can do with your iPhone. So the tools exist to assist manufacturers in controlling this behavior. So they can do so and are likely to be doing so even more commonly than they are at present. Which presents the policy question to which I want to devote the remainder of this lecture. If, as it appears, we're going to be seeing more and more efforts by manufacturers to manage this behavior, should we help them or not? Should the legal system be deployed in ways that assist their efforts to restrict or prevent these activities? Or conversely, should the legal system be interpreted or modified in ways that discourage manufacturers from restricting or preventing these activities? So the argument in favor of the manufacturers, of permitting them to use their already formidable array of tools to prevent this conduct, the primary argument here is a straightforward application, a reasonably straightforward application of the incentive argument that dominates intellectual property law as a whole, or at least dominates copyright and patent law. The ability already embodied in Section 106 of the copyright statute and Sections 271 of the patent statute to control the behavior of users is one of the economic rights that provides the carrot for the innovative activity that generated the product in the first instance. Manufacturers can make more money if they can control this behavior. So, examples of how they would do so, the right to prepare derivative works is quite frequently an important source of licensing revenue. An example would be the market for sequels of books. Gone with the Wind is an instance in which this market was implicated. Turning to tangible products, Steve Jobs has made explicit, understandably, his desire to restrict user-developed apps for the iPhone because he wants to compete with amateur developers in preparing for-profit Apple apps. In addition to licensing revenue of those sorts, manufacturers are legitimately concerned with reputational impacts. So it has been observed plausibly that if the behavior of modifying your iPhone were uncontrolled and you downloaded to your iPhone a poorly designed product and it didn't work well, there's a good chance you would blame Apple. And avoiding those reputational harms is a legitimate concern of manufacturers. If we prevent them from doing so, it reduces their incentives to create iPhones in the first instance. Some commentators note here that there's an additionally a risk of tort liability to which the manufacturers are appropriately sensitive. I actually think these hazards are remote, but worth mentioning anyway. There's a possibility, I suppose, that someone could be injured through the use of a modified device and would sue the manufacturer. Or in the debate about iPhones, it's sometimes said, well, what if you illegally used an iPhone app to help to record a conversation without permission? Wouldn't Apple be on the hook? No. But perhaps anxiety of that score influences manufacturers. So once you recognize that there's some money at stake here, then it gives rise to a general argument common in the intellectual property field. We should be wary about modifying intellectual property rights in ways that would corrode these sources of revenue, which sometimes can be quite substantial. Why? Because we risk, under those circumstances, diminishing socially valuable incentives to engage in the productive activity in the first instance. All right, that's the central argument. There are some others, but that's the central argument in favor of enabling and encouraging manufacturers to control behavior of this sort. So here are the arguments on the other side. I'm going to suggest that two of them are colorable, but not terribly powerful. And the third, Tan was exactly right in predicting the appearance of the term human flourishing, is the real serious argument in this area. And despite its unconventional character, I'm going to try to persuade you of its significance. So first, are there any efficiency reasons for enabling users to engage in this behavior? Right, this is going to be a hard argument to make because this is one instance in which the parties, the relevant parties, manufacturer and user, are actually or at least potentially in privity. They can do a deal. Under those circumstances, you would think that if it's efficiency enhancing to permit users to engage in this behavior, then one way or another, the manufacturers and the users are going to cut deals that will allow this behavior to go forward because it redounds to both of their advantage. So why does the legal system have to get involved here in curbing manufacturers' efforts to constrain this conduct? Well, there are some possible scenarios. So for example, in the intangible context, it is sometimes argued by economists that a privilege for parity is necessary because parity has large positive externalities, makes people laugh, makes them happy, and engages consumers more effectively to evaluate the quality of the products that are being parodied. Those externalities are difficult or impossible for the parodists to capture because they can't effectively charge all the people who would smile at the jokes as they spread. And consequently, the parodist will not be in a position to pay enough in the license fees to the copyright owners of the works parodied to achieve the optimal, socially optimal level of parody. So we need, specifically the fair use doctrine in copyright law, to permit this behavior to go forward. Okay, it's a colorable argument. In the field of user innovation, Eric von Hippel, who I mentioned earlier, argues forcefully in a recent book in this area that user innovation is efficiency enhancing in the industrial field. Why? Well, because first, users' needs are diverse. Next, agency costs make it hard for users to hire manufacturers or third parties to customize products for their idiosyncratic needs. Next, the users acquire information about their needs through experience, and that information is sticky in the sense that it's hard for the users to convey this individualized knowledge to the manufacturers. Last but not least, it's fun to engage in this behavior. This is a theme I'm going to return to in a minute. Users enjoy it, and so for all these reasons, we want to encourage users to engage in this conduct. But the manufacturers, sadly, do not as yet commonly appreciate the benefits of user innovation, and therefore we have to be vigilant in assuming that, in assuring they don't use the legal system to shut down this conduct. Right, that's the argument. It's not especially strong in this area because on its own premises, it's an argument really in favor of education, providing information to manufacturers and users concerning the mutual benefits of this behavior. And as I indicated earlier, there's a quite sizable group of commentators in the marketing literature trying to persuade manufacturers of exactly this. Don't really need to modify the legal system to foster this kind of conduct. You just need to alert manufacturers to the ways in which this behavior benefits them at the same time it benefits consumers. Second argument, distributive justice. We want to foster this kind of behavior because it increases the welfare of poor people, either domestically or internationally. There's an important line of scholarship in copyright law, well represented by essays by Molly von Howling, explaining how and why the copyright system can and should be modified so as to advance progressive redistribution of wealth or creative power in this fashion. Here's an illustration from the user innovation side. It's an illustration of the argument, but I'm also going to suggest it's a cautionary tale. It's not a great illustration. So this is provided by my colleague Ethan Zuckerman, who wrote this wonderful paper on variety of forms of recent innovation in Africa. One of the stories he tells involves efforts, philanthropic efforts, to replace charcoal as the primary fuel used by most rural households to cook. Turns out that charcoal, although it was once a perfectly sensible way of doing cooking, is now bad for a variety of reasons. Most of the forests are now gone. Charcoal generates a lot of pollution. Charcoal cooking fires are frequently kept indoors. It generates noxious smoke. There are no chimneys, which is bad for the health of kids. To gather the firewood necessary to engage in charcoal cooking, people, often women, have to go outside of the villages where they're vulnerable to being raped. As a result, they tend to ask their kids to do it rather than the women. The kids are vulnerable to abuse of various sorts. Charcoal turns out to be bad. So there's lots of social reasons to benefit the poor in developing countries to provide them an alternative. First major effort to do so was a commendable but centralized project by Bosch and Siemens in Germany to develop a stove that could be used by residents of developing countries to burn, for cooking purposes, plant palm oil, which is reasonably readily available. Sounds like a great idea, introduced with considerable fanfare. Didn't work. And what did work was a locally developed innovation that didn't require a significant shift in technology. And so specifically, biomass charcoal is a way of generating charcoal not from trees or wood, its traditional source, but by compressing, using these sort of homemade presses, the byproducts of agriculture, stalks and stuff left over from growing. Squish it hard enough and dry it in certain ways, and it makes very good charcoal, which can then be a substitute for the charcoal in the home. So it turns out to be not as good as the stoves, but much more acceptable to the residents that you're trying to help. Now, from this tale, Zuckerman derives the following general lessons. Localism, rely on locally made technology, local materials, local repair, don't fight culture, don't displace the people who are making money from an existing technology, innovate on existing platforms, and in general, avoid centralized innovation, rely on distributed user-generated innovation. Because this is an argument in favor of the distributive justice benefits of relying on user innovation, enabling and encouraging it. But it's not a great story from this standpoint because it is subject to, I think, a strong counterargument. The colloquial term here is local maximum problem. The nub of this story is that charcoal is being replaced by this new technology, but it's not as good as the palm oil stoves. We've made an improvement, but not as good as one that could have been made if we were willing to tolerate a short-term, more severe wrenching of local culture. So, bottom line here is that the argument for distributive justice, and particularly vis-a-vis developing countries, of fostering user innovation as opposed to centralized innovation is not rock solid. So, this leaves the argument least conventional in the intellectual property field, but in my view, the most honest way to justify modifications of the legal system that would encourage this kind of conduct. So I'm going to present some variations here. These are arguments drawn from different disciplines, but in my view, they overlap. They're just using different languages to get at the same central concerns. All right, so one language is semiotic democracy. This is a phrase originated within John Fiske's and his studies of consumer culture. It's now used by a growing number of intellectual property scholars. The key idea here is fairly straightforward, that for a long time, basically most of the 20th century, we've witnessed ever greater concentration of the power of making cultural meanings. And recently, new technologies, above all digital technologies and the communicative power of the internet, is making possible a reversal of those trends and the redistribution of the capacity to make and shake the cloud of images through which we move and in which we define ourselves. And user innovation, with respect to tangible products, represents a redistribution of semiotic power, just as the more familiar examples of user innovation vis-a-vis copyrighted materials. All right, that's one language. Second language, less common among intellectual property scholars, this comes out of psychology. A group of psychologists led by Desi and Ryan have argued under an umbrella now known as self-determination theory that all people have innate psychological needs. The three they emphasize are competence, to experience oneself as capable and competent in controlling the environment and reliably predicting outcomes. Autonomy, which they define as volition, the organismic desire to self-organize experience and behavior and have activity be concordant with one's integrated sense of self. And relatedness, somewhat more intuitively plausible concept involving connections with others. Those three fundamental human needs, these psychologists argue, are essential for psychological growth, integrity, and well-being, and they point to a growing body of empirical research suggesting in a wide variety of contexts that satisfaction of these needs gives rise to not just happiness, but powerful intrinsic motivations to sustain commitment to and success at a variety of tasks. And that hypothesis verified through examinations of motivations for commitment to and success at a bunch of activities, including education, sports, breaking addiction to alcohol and drugs, and so forth. So if they're right about these fundamental psychological needs, then, turning to our problem before us, user innovation of the sort I've described has among its merits that it offers opportunities to satisfy simultaneously all three of these needs. Confronting and solving technical problems through user innovation, developing the skills necessary to do so, contributes to a sense of competence, a powerful sense of competence on the part of the users themselves. The users typically are autonomous in their choice of tasks, and they engage in communities, increasingly widespread communities of innovators. And that's a topic we'll return to in just a minute. All right, that's psychology. Political theory. Here the main figure is Marx, who's building on Aristotle. One of Marx's central arguments in his early writings, not his later writings, is that productive activity is the life of the species. And more specifically, it's essential to becoming fully human that one have the capacity, opportunity to engage in what Marx called, or at least in translation, meaningful work. What's meaningful work? Meaningful work is work that requires skill and concentration, presents the laborer with challenges and problems he or she can overcome only through the exercise of initiative and creativity, and is part of a larger project he or she considers socially valuable, must take into account. Marx had as one of his main criticisms the emergence of industrialization, that it deprived many people, the majority of people, of opportunity to meaningful work of this sort. Many of the theorists, follows in his wake, argue in favor of social and legal reform that would increase opportunities for meaningful work, and there's a growing body of empirical literature suggesting that Marx had it right. So, the application of this phenomenon, this argument, to user innovation is, should be pretty clearly straightforward. The features that Marx identified as essential to meaningful work are all embodied in user innovation. It's one of the reasons why I emphasized in the examples at the start of the lecture the instances in which professionals engage in this behavior. This is not just a hobbyist. These are people whose livelihood depends on conduct of this sort. Communitarianism, not so popular recently in political philosophy, but still a powerful argument. Central claim here is our identities are substantially socially determined, and that impact is nurturing and fulfilling, not imprisoning. You see myriad examples of this in user innovation. The flourishing lowrider culture now spreading beyond Southern California, which has associated with it not just cruising, but dance competitions, car dancing competitions, barbecues, parties, and so forth. The culture of customizers and bicyclists in Britain, which has been documented recently. Here are some examples from the community of router users. I offer this to give a little bit of flavor here. So I signed up for this a little while ago, and here's what happens when you sign up with routerforums.com. They welcome you. Come on in, introduce yourself before you start exchanging information, okay? So you go to the introductions page, and you find testimonials or invitations of this general sort. Hi, everyone. I've been looking at the forum off and on for a long time now. I'm into woodworking as a hobby, but I hope to start making money for me during the winter. Okay, this is another example of the transition from amateur to professional and so forth and so on. And then one of the things striking here is, here in Croatia, it's hard enough to find some decent router bits, let alone information on Jigs, so I'm really grateful for information on this score, suggesting the global character of the community. So here's the kind of innovation that people are engaged in. Somebody wants to build a workbench. Well, you could go to Woodcraft and buy this Swedish design workbench for $2,400. That's a lot of money. So instead, people tend to build their own workbenches. They buy some manufactured products, including the pegs that hold the work in question, and then they want to build some of the infrastructure themselves, and they ask for advice. I'm a novice. Here's what I'm planning to do. Can you give me some help? Should I use a portable drill bit or a plunge router? And then people weigh in. Well, here's what I suggest, and here's what I suggest, and here's what I suggest, and what are you using, by the way, for materials? Where I'm using these Veritas dogs. That's a commercial product here. Well, that tells me a little bit more about what you're going to need, and so forth and so on. So it's this open exchange of ideas. Nobody's asking for compensation here. What they're asking for, and this is important, I'm going to come back to it in a minute, is credit. They want to be given credit when they provide an idea that somebody else puts to use. And this is the sort of thing that emerges at the other end of the process. Okay, the last of the languages under this general heading of human flourishing, which, as I say, is all of these converge is the so-called capabilities approach associated with Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, who, drawing upon Aristotle, the Stoics, the framers of the federal constitution, 19th century British philosophy, and intuitions about ordinary folk, argue that all people have a right to access to circumstances that will enable them to achieve fundamental human capabilities. Okay, not full development of their capacities, but basic capacities. Now, Sen and Nussbaum disagree somewhat on what exactly those capabilities are, but this is Nussbaum's list, contained most famously in a 2000 book on women and distributive justice. This is what she argues are the central human capabilities. And turns out, again, that user innovation maps on to at least four of these. Senses, imagination, and thought, so specifically being able to use one's imagination in connection with experience in producing works in defense of one's own choice, literary, religious, literary, musical, and so forth. Affiliation, which is communities. Play, and control over one's material environment. So, from many different angles, I'm arguing this conduct, not just in its familiar intangible form, but in a less familiar tangible form, is central to human flourishing, and that's the real reason why the legal system should be adjusted to encourage this behavior and to discourage manufacturers of the products that are being modified from impeding it. Okay, if you agree to this point, then that raises some practical questions. So how would you modify the legal system so as to foster this kind of behavior? Well, the most natural area of doctrinal reform would involve giving greater latitude to users. So here there are a bunch of things you could do. You could modify that fair use doctrine in property in copyright law so as to give greater latitude for transformational activities. But transformation defined slightly differently from the way it is in current doctrine. Transformation defined not, as some courts do, as work that's critical of the plaintiff's work, or work that generates a derivative work in a different form, or serves a different function, or socially valuable, but rather transformation in the sense of uses of copyrighted material that either constitute or facilitate creative engagement with intellectual products. This is a process-based definition of transformation, focuses on how the defendant's work was produced, not what the relationship is between the defendant's work and the plaintiff's. Okay, another doctrine you could modify would be the first sale doctrine in copyright law, the analogous first sale doctrine in patent law. This is not my idea, this is Pam Samuelson's, who rightly argues that a widely shared view among ordinary consumers is this object I purchased is mine. I should be able to do what I want to with it. And the first sale doctrines incompletely track that popular sentiment. Expansion of them would create greater opportunities for user innovation. Jack Balkin and Neil Nathanael have suggested expansive interpretations of freedom of speech as another way of facilitating user innovation. A transformative use defense in right of publicity violations would also help. The Ninth Circuit is experimenting with this. Different panel decisions come out in different ways. An expanded experimental use doctrine in patent law. This would involve a modified version of Strandberg's famous and deservedly famous proposal in this area. Loosening, as she also suggests, the repair-reconstruction distinction in patent law. Interpretation of warranties that are more favorable to users' ability to modify the products that come into their hands. The possibility of establishing in patent law a fair use doctrine analogous to copyright law. Curbs on some rules in trademark law that could be employed by manufacturers, above all dilution doctrine, which has problems independent of this. And a more generous list of exemptions to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act than it currently affords. All right, those would all be changes that would give users greater freedom to engage in these behaviors without fear of legal liability. What about giving the users themselves rights to the innovations they came up with? So there's an argument here that the patent system could be modified to do this. And specifically, the experimental use exception to the public use statutory bar could be tweaked to the advantage of users who typically, late in the game, come to appreciate the patentability of their modifications. There are a few other doctrines of patent law that you could adjust for these purposes. But I think on this front that the positions taken by both Strandberg and Benkler, that we don't need patent incentives to encourage behavior of this sort, and if you don't need the patent system to foster this sort of behavior, don't use it, because it has side effects. So my view in brief here is that we ought not supplement liberty to engage in this behavior with financial returns. It doesn't mean, however, that we shouldn't strive to preserve in this environment a right of attribution. One of the central rights, as you know, associated with the moral rights tradition and copyright law, turns out that innovators at the user level, as well as at the pioneering level, care about being given credit for what they do. And that's something the intellectual property system could strive to preserve as a form of user rights. Last of the implications, less obvious, doesn't have to do with intellectual property directly, it's broadband policies. Many of these innovations are either made on or information about them is shared through the internet. And so access to these communities is dependent upon access to technologies. And so broadband policy affects the availability of conduct of this sort. So if we care about fostering behavior of this kinds I've described here, we should seek through the broadband policies that are currently up for grabs in the United States and Australia and some countries in Europe to achieve the following things: increased penetration rates, increased speeds, making upload speeds match or approach download speeds, encouraging people to make their materials available as much as receive information distributed to them, and finally, a particular form of network neutrality. Complicated field, but under this broad umbrella, there are a variety of forms of network neutrality that are currently being debated by the new FCC. The forms that are most relevant to the phenomenon I've tried to describe today are sender neutrality, proposition that an ISP ought not be able to differentiate among senders, and the toll-free principle that an ISP can't charge senders. So, to sum up, I've tried to argue that there is a growing phenomenon of distributed creativity, some portions of which are very well known and much studied, and another portion involving modifications of tangible products is much less familiar. The technological change is facilitating this, in particular by encouraging communications among users and sometimes among primary innovators and follow-on innovators. Intellectual property owners sometimes seek to block or control or monetize these behaviors, and that the legal system offers them a powerful array of tools to do so. On balance, we should strive, nevertheless, to give innovators of these various sorts more latitude than the legal system currently affords them, and I've tried to identify some adjustments to the legal system that would advance that end. Thanks very much.